Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley. And our guest today is Martha Hall Kelly. Martha's debut novel, Lilac Girls, became a New York Times bestseller the week it was published in 2016, and then went on to sell over 2 million copies and publish in 50 countries. The novel is based on the true story of 72 Polish women who were imprisoned and experimented on at Ravensbrück concentration camp. And then her next book was Lost Roses, which was about Caroline's mother, Caroline being one of the characters in Lilac Girls. The Golden Doves, Returns to World War II, was another book. And the one we're talking about today is the Martha's Vineyard Beach and Book Club. Martha grew up in Massachusetts and now splits her time between Litchfield, Connecticut, Hope Sound, Florida, and New York City. And where are you talking to us from today, Martha?
From Martha's Vineyard.
Awesome.
Massachusetts.
Now, are you named after Martha's Vineyard?
I am, yes. I love it. That was such a gift that my parents gave me.
Wow. So, yeah, tell me a little bit about your family history and how you've used your family history in your historical novels.
Well, it all started back in 1891 when my mother's family, the Smiths, settled on Martha's Vineyard. The farmhouse that they lived in is still here today. And my mother grew up in that house and used to tell us stories about World War II on Martha's Vineyard. And that's why I decided to write the book, because it was such a fascinating hidden history. That they grew up, my mom and her three siblings, really poor. Not Angela's ashes poor, but it was after the Depression. My grandmother, my mother's mother, named Emma Smith, she lost her husband when the kids were little. So she had to make ends meet here on the vineyard in the 1940s, and it was not easy. She took in laundry. She cooked for other people. She was an amazing baker, and she used to make donuts and sell them out in front of their house for 25 cents a dozen, which nowadays, I can't even imagine that she could make any profit from that. I know things were way cheaper back then, but my mom used to talk about how when she got a little bit older and the war started and there was an army base out there, and she said that the convoys of jeeps would go by their house and stop to get her grandmother's warm donuts. And she said that they came from all over. They weren't just from Martha's Vineyard and Cape Cod. They were from every state, a lot from Texas, actually. And they were there training for Normandy because the coastlines are very similar. No one knew it at the time, but my mom said they were so handsome, and Martha's Vineyard was so proud of their boys, they called them. But almost half of them didn't return after Normandy. And, you know, of course, we know now that, you know, the casualties were so heavy. And she said they always were so sad by that. And she was, and she would talk about that a lot. So that's one of the first things I started with the new book. And then I was starting to have some writer's block. And my daughter, who's my best editor, she said, why don't you make it your actual family that the characters are based on? And once I did that, and I found all these letters from my mother that talked about the time, my writer's block just, you know, vanished when I made the grandmother in the book my actual grandmother, and she makes the actual things that she used to make, baked all the cookies. I found her old cookie recipe cookbook from her church. You know how church ladies put together these wonderful little local cookbooks. And I
oh,
made
aren't they
one
the
of
best?
The
aren't those church lady cookbooks the best?
Yeah. And this is from the 1950s, so everything was made with shortening and lard, and I'm sure it tasted way better back then. But so I made my mother one of the characters, and my uncle Sonny, who got shot down over Messina, Italy. He was a ball ball turret gunner. And I made him one of the characters. So that's when it really came alive for me.
Wow. Now, you've kind of used family history before, too, in your earlier books as well. Are there any that your family has not played a part in?
Well, I use someone else's family. In Lilac Girls, it was Karen and Faraday's family.
Okay.
Yeah. And I had gotten to know her so well. She passed away in the 1990s, but I got to know her through everything she left behind in her family photos. And so I kind of borrowed her family.
Okay. Gotcha.
To write all three of the books in the series.
Wow.
And I talk about her mother in one book and then her great-grandmother. But this is the first time I've written about my own family.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. So you did have actual letters that from your mother.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. The way it happened was so strange. I think she visited me. She died back in 2000 or 1999. But I was really struggling at the beginning with this book, and I was thinking, did I not ask my mother more questions about growing up and just being a more generous daughter and being more interested in her? And because it really would have helped with the book. And one day I was up in my attic in Connecticut, and I came across an envelope, a manila envelope, with her kind of label on it. So I knew that it was from her. And she used to send me things before she died. Oh, just newspaper clippings and articles and everything. And I found it and I thought, oh my God, I have never opened this. And my first thought was, what a terrible daughter. I was busy with three kids and it was crazy. But I just thought, why did I not open my mom's letter? So I did that. I opened the envelope. And inside were a newsy letter from her about books. She loved books. And also a stack of essays that my aunt had written, who also obviously lived in that same house. And they were all about Martha's Vineyard during the war, all about my grandmother and the details. And I swear to you, it was my mother revisiting me. And I know because I opened up a second envelope that was in there, like a smaller manila envelope. And it was packed with little cartoons, and she had a list of books that my daughter should read, which my daughter was 30 by the time I opened the letter. And I tilted the envelope to make sure I shook everything out, and a tiny gold heart came out, and it landed on my palm, and I just sat there in the attic thinking, my mother has visited me, and she's saying, I'm with you. And I also think she was kind of saying, you should write about books, and because she loved them so much. And that's when I made the book all about books. And she had a book club, and I made it about her book club. And it just, once I did that, the book really sang.
So which character in the book is your mother?
There's two sisters and a brother at the Smiths, and they're brought up by their grandmother. And my mother is Cadence, and Cadence is the older daughter. She's very beautiful. She is very into books. She wants to go to New York City and be in publishing, and she cannot wait to get off of Martha's Vineyard. And that was completely my mother. People say, why would she ever want to leave such a beautiful place? But she was desperate to leave the island. She always jokes that that's why she married my father, who was in the Coast Guard, and she met him at the Marine Hospital there, where she was a medical secretary. She loved him, obviously, but she always talks about, you know, the first guy that came along that could take her off the island, she was ready.
Wow.
So that's Kate. So she is.
But she came back.
She did. She did. Now, my father loved Martha's Vineyard and always wanted to live there. So when they retired, they came back to Martha's Vineyard, and they sold that farmhouse and moved into this beautiful sea captain's home where I'm sitting right now.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah.
So you did not grow up on Martha's Vineyard.
I did not. I think my mother, she was adamant about two things. One was that we should be readers, really, really strong readers growing up, and that we should be able to be not on an island, and that we should have everything, all the opportunities that come with that. Now, my sister, my little sister, she bought my parents' house, so she came back to Martha's Vineyard, but I live in Connecticut.
Okay. But you obviously have a strong connection to the vineyard as well.
Oh, I'm here all the time. Yeah.
So you did a lot of research in addition to the, I mean, I'm sure those letters gave you a really good foundation for what it was like during the war there. But tell us a little bit about some of the other research that you did.
Oh, now my mother had told me stories about all of this, but I never really dug into it. And once I did, oh my goodness, there's an incredible amount of hidden history that happened here during the war that just kind of got lost. I mean, some of the people here still remember it. One of my mother's best friends, Shirley Kennedy, that she had since she was very young here, is still with us. She won't tell me how old she is because she said people think you're old when you tell them. I mean, I can do the math, but she was lovely and sat down with me and shared a lot about what she remembers growing up. So that was helpful. But in my research, I found out that two things that I thought were really astounding. One was there were Nazi submarines, U-boats, all around the waters here. And some of the Kriegsmarine soldiers actually came on shore. And there are all sorts of rumors. My mom used to talk about two men that actually had dinner at one of the local restaurants that's still here. And that was corroborated by a local historian here. And they would surface at night, and the islanders would hear them out recharging their batteries, the hum of a Nazi submarine. And they would approach fishermen here on the island and take their lobsters. And they went to one Portuguese fisherman. There were a lot of Portuguese settlers here on the island from the whaling days, and a lot of them were fishermen. And a Nazi sub surfaced and scared the daylights out of this one fisherman, boarded his boat and took his lobsters and his fish and the stew that he was making. And in exchange, they gave him a case of schnapps, which after they left, he was so shaken, he threw the case of schnapps overboard. Because he didn't want to get in trouble. But I think it's probably still there if anyone wants to, you know,
to go diving for schnapps. Yeah.
Yes. That would be so cool.
Wouldn't it?
So that happened. And then the other thing that I found out that my mom had kind of briefly mentioned was the U.S. military invaded Martha's Vineyard in order to do mock invasions of what was going to happen in Normandy. And they were very, very secret. People on the island knew about them because you can't just keep that secret totally, but they weren't allowed to write about it in the newspapers. And they used all the very latest amphibious vehicles to come over from Cape Cod and do an actual invasion. They had planes flying low over the beach. They had barge balloons, you know, those big, what looked like dirigibles. And they had this force that was their job was to take the island, to get to the new airport. And that's how they would succeed in their mission, just as they would in their mission to come at Normandy. And they had opposing forces, Americans, pretending to be opposing forces on the beaches. And they were supposed to stop the men from getting to the airport. And they spoiler alert, they did make it. But all the top brass from Washington was standing on the cliff watching. And one woman in Vineyard Haven, which is the town that my parents' house is in now, they remember looking out their window and seeing soldiers in full military dress with guns on their bellies going through her garden on their way to the airport. Yeah.
Wow.
So they invaded Martha's Vineyard, which I thought was really, really fascinating.
It is. And it's also, we don't think of the war having been that close, but that there were actually German submarines right off the shore.
Absolutely.
We learned We had a book many years ago on Writers' Voices that my mother keeps bringing up. And my mother, Caroline, would have liked to have joined us today, but she's not really feeling up to doing it anymore. And yeah, but she did read your book, and she loved it. But there were ships sunk in the Gulf of Mexico, passenger ships even by German U-boats, and we don't hear that much about this.
All up and down the eastern seaboard.
Yeah.
All around. It got to the point where they were downing merchant ships, the Nazi wolf packs of U-boats, in such huge numbers. It was a crisis, and there was nothing they could do about it because they didn't have the technology quite then. A few years into the war, they did develop better technology, but at first they were sinking merchant ships, American and UK ships, because Hitler didn't want those supplies coming over to help the Allies with the war. We weren't in the war in 1942 quite yet, but they were downing ships in record numbers.
I am surprised that we didn't get into the war just on the basis of U.S. merchant ships being sunk. You would think that would have been enough.
Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Pearl Harbor that people really went, okay, we can't do this anymore.
Right. Right.
Yeah. No, actually, that was 1941,
okay.
And this was 1942. So we were in the war.
Okay.
But they were still downing all that whole year of 1942, even though we were in the war. They were downing our merchant ships and UK ships to get rid of. They were sending over oil and machinery to help in the war.
Right. Right.
It was really sad. Whole crews would be lost.
Wow.
And that's what they were doing there. That's what the U-boats were, just hanging around in order to, you know, a lot of times Liberty ships would come down from Boston where they were put together, and they were going towards the harbor in New York, and they would get them either there or on their way out of New York, on their way up towards Europe.
And did the U.S. have submarines at that point, too?
We did, but it was really hard to, you know, the best way to get the submarines, they found out later, was from the air. Actually, my father-in-law, Michael Kelly, was in the Navy. He was a pilot, and that's what he did. He went after the Nazi U-boats. So later, once they had the technology to find them, that's how they really made great headway, and there were way fewer ships lost after that. But in the beginning, one submarine would chase a U-boat, and they were skilled at getting away, and they were really good at when convoys would come by, they would get a whole convoy. It was terrifying, and the men knew that, you know, they were sitting ducks.
Wow. Now, you did some research at the Cape Cod Military Museum?
Yes, they were really, really helpful. And he actually is the one that told me about the Portuguese sailor and how the fisherman and how they the U-boats took his catch.
Wow.
Well, he's over on Cape Cod, which is where Camp Edwards was. And that was the real hub here on the Cape and Islands. It was Camp Edwards.
Okay. Okay. And tell me a little bit about the fifth column and what that means.
And that's another thing I didn't really know anything about. The fifth column was people that were here in the United States that were Nazi sympathizers. And they were underground, obviously. No one knew who they were, but they worked to sabotage things in the United States. And they were also just active followers of Hitler's. There was a whole community in Yaphank, Long Island, that were sympathizers. They had streets called Hitler Street or Himmler Street, and they had swastikas bricked into the facades of their houses. You can go there today and still see that little community. People are still living there. They had camps that were Nazi camps, Nazi sympathizer camps. They did their best to kind of cozy up to Hitler, but he wasn't into that as much. Some of them went over and visited him, but he was like, I don't know why, but he just wasn't, he didn't trust them, I don't think.
Okay. And, but this plays a role in the book.
It does. It's a bit of a spoiler.
Yeah. All right. So we won't tell too much about it.
Well, I think even on the jacket cover, it talks about how there's a spy in their midst. Okay. And they don't know who it is.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and yes. And Briar, the younger sister, by the way, where'd that name come from?
I just loved it. You know, Cadence came from, I was out on the West Coast and we ate at a restaurant and our waitress's name was Cadence. And I thought, oh, that's beautiful. So I used Cadence. And then Briar, I just thought her mom, who had passed away by the time, you know, we get to their story in the book. But I just think her mom, it was a good Martha's Vineyard name. And it's kind of perfect for her because she's a little bit prickly. She's really, really smart. So far, you know, it's early in the book's life, but people tell me that Briar is their favorite. She's young. She's really into Nazi memorabilia. She walks the beach looking for any kind of Nazi stuff that washes up. But I think that, you know, we might say she's on the spectrum today. I mean, back then they didn't know what that was, but I think she's a little bit, you know. Neurodivergent.
Yeah. Yes. And she's convinced that there is a spy.
Well, she's convinced that there are Nazi U-boats that are like hanging around.
Yeah.
And everybody she tells that to, they call her Briar the Liar because they think she's crazy. But she's really, really smart and they should have listened to her. Let's just put it that way.
Now, the other thing that was really interesting was the Armed Services Editions.
Oh, my goodness. That was another thing I found out about that I didn't know about. They were these, I was at a flea market on Martha's Vineyard. They have the best, it's called the Chilmark Flea. And I found a book, a really old paperback, about these Armed Services Editions. And they were little tiny books. I'd say no bigger than, well, like a pack of cards, but a big pack of cards. And the U.S. military, you know, while Germany was burning books, we were printing over 1 million of these little armed services editions. And they were over 1,500 titles that the Army printed in this tiny, it's a full book, but in a tiny paperback edition, and it's the perfect size to fit into their backpacks because the men couldn't even fit a paperback in their packs. You know, they were loaded with all sorts of military stuff. So out of a cookie jar, they pulled the names on slips of paper of the books that they were going to make for the boys. And so I put that in the book. I have Cadence come up with that idea, and she's hoping that that's what helps her get to New York City. But I just had to include that because I thought it was so interesting.
So the characters that Cadence meets, the women that Cadence meets who work in the publishing industry, the kind of the rich girls, are they based on real people?
No, the Putnam ladies?
Yes, yeah.
If anyone, they're based on my publishers. I have this amazing team at Random House. And I kind of base them on them because, you know, they're very savvy, strong women and very funny. And I just thought I'd immortalize them in the book. Cadence and her best friend, Bess, who's very wealthy, but has been kind of thrown out of her household because she's dating Cadence's brother, Tom, who's super cute and goes off to war. The two of them work at this place where my mom and her best friend used to work. And it's now a very sweet little beach club, yacht club, but at the time it was called the Bayside Club, and it was also kind of a private club, but you could play tennis there. And in the book, I have Cadence and her best friend Bess working there, and they're way into books, and she meets this wonderful woman named Winnie, and Winnie's very fancy and lives on West Chop, which here in Martha's Vineyard is very, a lovely part of the island, and a lot of wealthy people live out there. And Winnie, it could be her ticket out, she thinks. And Winnie takes her under her wing because Cadence writes for the local newspaper, which is the Gazette, which is still the paper of Martha's Vineyard. And she writes a column about books, and it's very funny. And she shouts out local people, and so Winnie takes her under her wing and says, "I want you to meet my friends, the Putnam girls." And they come up on their yacht, which they dock over at in Edgartown, which is like a very fancy town here on Martha's Vineyard. So she goes to the Edgartown Yacht Club, Cadence does, to meet with these ladies, and they invite her to come to New York, and her dream is realized. But of course,
Things get in the way.
something life happens.
Life
Yes,
happens. Yes.
yeah.
Were there actual women columnists in the Gazette at that time? Do you know?
I read after I finished the book. I don't know about women, probably. But Armour Towles, the writer, he wrote a column as a kid for the Gazette, which was funny. I had
Seriously?
no idea.
Whoa.
I'm sure it was amazing. He's such a good writer.
I'm old enough to remember when every small town had a little newspaper, and the smallest of them went by the wayside probably 30 years ago, and
Oh, it's so sad.
now most of the rest of them, even in larger small towns, are disappearing rapidly too. But I remember moving to this little tiny town in Iowa, and that had a weekly paper, and there was always a column of sort of social events that had happened in the town. And it was, but it was always the same people, because whoever was writing it only knew certain people, and so it was always about the same people. And I always remember, it's like every time it would say, so and so went to, so and so's house for Sunday dinner, and they had chicken and waffles and whatever. And it always ended the same way. And a good time was had by all.
Oh, I love that. I love that. That's so old-fashioned, and I love
Isn't
that.
it?
Even that
Isn't
just
it?
captures the period, doesn't it?
Yes.
I so mourn the demise of the local newspaper. I think that it's so sad.
Yeah.
It's yeah. Here they have one, and each of the little towns on Martha's Vineyard has a reporter that reports in, and one of them, for a while, I don't know if it's anymore, they used to talk about this mean turkey that was terrorizing everyone. And the turkey would go to people's houses and like go after them. And so I used to get the newspaper just to find out what was happening with the
With the
mean turkey.
Now, the
Well,
Martha's Vineyard Beach and Book Club actually is a story within a story. So there's sort of a dual timeline. And
there
yes,
is.
so tell us a little bit about that and why you chose to structure it that way.
Well, my daughter suggested I do it, and I was growing tomatoes, and chipmunks got at them, and they were eating all of my heirloom tomatoes, and I was really upset about it. So I thought, I have to take them while they're green and do something with them. So I looked up fried green tomatoes, and while I was cooking them, I watched the movie again. I had always loved that movie, Fried Green Tomatoes. And I started realizing they have a dual timeline. And it is the Kathy Bates character, the older lady, I think it's Jessica Tandy plays her in the film. She retells the story of her life. And I just thought, why don't I do that? And so I just came up with, my daughter's an actor in Los Angeles. And I thought, well, in case this ever becomes a movie, I want to have a part for her. So I put in a young woman who comes from Los Angeles to Martha's Vineyard. What happened, because her mother passed away, and in her effects, she found the name of this famous painter in Martha's Vineyard named Elizabeth Devereaux. And so she comes to Martha's Vineyard to confront the woman under the guise of taking a painting class and says, "My mother never left California. Why were you in touch with her?" And Mrs. Devereaux says, "Well, you're going to need to sit down. I need to tell you a story." And so she tells her the story of these two sisters, Cadence and Briar, who lived on Martha's Vineyard. And as the story progresses, you start to understand how that young girl, Mari, the Los Angeles girl, is connected to this family.
Right. Although you don't really know till the end.
Yes.
You can guess. Yes. You can guess, but...
Did you guess?
I thought yes, sort of. I was trying to figure out, you know, time wise, age wise, and stuff, what the actual connection would be, but eventually I did. Yeah,
that was my favorite part about writing the book. It was so fun to kind of leave those little clues.
Yeah,
and the funny thing is, Mary called me one day and said, "Mom, guess who is reading the audiobook?" And Mary got the part of Mari. So yeah, it was really, really moving to be there. I was in LA and I read my author's note and then she read her part of the book. Wow. So it was really very moving. I think my mom would have been really happy about that.
Yeah. Well, Martha, why don't you read a little bit from the Martha's Vineyard Beach and Book Club for us?
Oh, okay. How about the first chapter?
Perfect.
And it's Mari. So, you know, that kind of is a nice segue. Mari, chapter one, 2016. I hoisted my backpack over my shoulder and joined the crush of people streaming down the ferry's gangplank. I'd made it to Martha's Vineyard at last, that storied island. I'd heard it was almost too charming, that Princess Diana had stayed there. Lots of presidents, Carly Simon and James Taylor once upon a time. There had to be something cool about it. I stood under the canopy and scanned the people coming to meet their friends and families. Mrs. Devereaux had been so vague in her letter. "Take the 9:30 ferry. I'll fetch you in Vineyard Haven." Had I gotten the day wrong? I wiped the sweat off my upper lip. I'd forgotten my sunglasses and was jet-lagged from taking the red eye from LA to Boston. An amped-up bridal party pressed by me in a haze of misty ore, gold mylar balloons bobbing above them. Matching straw hats identified them as bride and bride tribe, as if the world didn't know. I stepped back to let a couple not that much older than me walk by, a toddler in her father's arms and a sweet-looking mutt leashed behind. The perfect family. I walked across to the gray shingled terminal building, the asphalt radiating heat, and sat cross-legged on a bench, watching the crowd of rich-looking tourists, flannel-shirted farmer types, and lunch-tote-carrying workers from the mainland. Some were headed to those stately white houses that lined the harbor, the ones probably built by men with names like Ichabod, the kitchens done over with double sub-zeros and too much white marble. Life was good for people here in almost too charming land. I held my suede fringe bag close, one of my mother's favorites. My high-waisted jeans and halter top had seemed right at the time when I left LA, but from the few stares and glances cast in my direction, I now knew I looked out of place. Not that I cared much about dressing for others. I dressed for joy and my dwindling bank account. I'd eaten nothing but since the peanuts on the plane, because the ferry snack bar offered only industrial-looking clam chowder and some shriveled hot dogs. And a $10 deck of playing cards featuring a vintage Martha's Vineyard map, which I'd bought in a moment of impulse and regretted as soon as cash changed hands. I called Nate's number. "This is Nate. Sorry, I'm not here right now, but we'll talk soon." Why did he never pick up? He was always so busy with his tech startup, which was taking forever to start up. I sipped my bottle of club soda, an economical drink since the bubbles made me feel fuller, and watched my fellow passengers match up with their rides. A white Range Rover arrived, and the bridal party wrangled their balloons into the car and piled in. Soon a white-haired woman wearing a pink button-down shirt waved to the perfect family, and off they went, the mother fussing over the daughter or daughter-in-law. It made me miss my own mom. Not that my mother would have worn anything remotely buttoned down. If a shirt didn't have a 70s vibe, Nancy Starwood wasn't wearing it. We'd spent hours browsing the LA thrift shops as a team, hunting through the racks on Melrose, on the lookout for band tees and vintage Levi's. All the shop owners loved her charming way and always saved her the good stuff. Soon the crowds thinned. Where was Mrs. Devereaux? I checked my phone and found it non-responsive. Maybe a new phone with some battery life would be a good thing to save for. I turned the golden bracelet on my wrist, a habit I'd just acquired. Before I left LA, I found a circle of gold hearts in an electric pink sock my mom used to store her jewelry in. The hearts were kind of corny, and the bracelet wasn't really my mother's style or mine either, but it gave me an odd sort of comfort now. I approached a woman wearing an orange vest who stood waving cars onto the ferry to return to the mainland. Where's the closest public phone? My ride hasn't shown up. Across the street, the woman said, Vineyard Bikes will let you use theirs. I dodged cars and hurried into the shop. Bikes filled every inch of the place, even hanging from the rafters, and I ran one finger along the seat of a tandem bike resting along the wall. That much togetherness would be a mistake, no matter how good the relationship. A guy I guessed was in his mid-30s, maybe 2 years older than me, stood bent over an overturned bicycle, his hair pulled back in a messy bun. He spun the wheel with a satisfying ticking sound. I basked in the cool darkness of the place and admired his strong-looking back, a body part underappreciated in men. I waved, hey, hey, he looked up and tucked a stray lock behind one ear. Great bag. I ran one hand down the suede, taken aback that a male human had admired a piece of my clothing, a first for me. My mother's. I'm sorry, but the person I was supposed to meet is a no-show. Mind if I use your phone? He nodded towards the counter. Have at it. I dialed the number from the letter, and while it rang, I considered the bike man's profile and decided if he had been born in the 17th century, he could have passed for a Flemish painter or composer. Is it always this crowded? I asked, phone to my ear. It's an August Friday, yes. So yes. March, not so much. I liked the way he said the March in that famous Massachusetts accent. I hung up the phone. No one there. I stepped to the window and checked the ferry terminal again. After paying my mother's funeral expenses, I couldn't afford a long cab ride. I'm here from LA. Just flew into Logan this morning. How much to rent a bike to ride to Chilmark? $20 a day. He glanced at me. But it's a tough ride. He straightened, brushed off his jeans, and gave me his full attention. Used to biking? I went on a Berkeley trip once back in college toward Hershey, Pennsylvania. Oh, that garden spot. But it was really fun, actually. I shooed away the image of my ex-boyfriend, Justin, riding off with Jennifer Sibley down Chocolate World Way. Well, you'd be fine biking the flat roads across the coast, but the roads up Island of Hylia. Trust me, just take Stagecoach Taxi. How much would that be, I asked. Around $60. I pictured the inside of my wallet and the two $20 bills and change there. At 34, I should have been well past the backpacking phase of life and able to afford a taxi. Just a late bloomer, my mother had said. That's kind of a lot for me right now. He reached up into the rafters and pulled down a pale green bike, a surprising feat of strength, and I stepped back to watch. I'd always found men who displayed physical labor more attractive than their office working counterparts. I get it. It's possible to live out here without a lot of money, but you have to be creative. I can do it for 10 if that helps. It does, thanks. He went to the counter and hovered his pen over the form. Name? Mari Starwood. He smiled. You could be a movie star with that name. I'd actually been christened Marigold Violet Starwood, named after a British soap my mother had a passing fancy for, but I rarely shared my full name, not because I didn't like it, more to avoid people's same old jokes about it. "Are you an actress? Being so what?" I asked. "I don't know." He searched my face for a few long seconds. "Beautiful." I glanced away, hiding my smile. He was just flirting, but that wasn't a word I'd use to describe myself. Interesting, perhaps, but black hair and Elvira white skin wasn't the most sought after vibe in LA, where blondes ruled. Just the thought that there might be a more relaxed beauty standard here in the land of farmers and fishermen made me feel newly buoyant. I told him I had to leave tonight on the 7:30 ferry. I'd scored a quick turnaround flight out of Boston for less than $300 round trip. "You'll want to stay longer. It's a unique place. The air alone here helps people reconsider things." "I need to go home. I'm moving. Going back to school for physical wellness. Hoping to make it a bit more money so I can afford a bigger place." I forced myself to stop oversharing with this random stranger and pulled the deck of cards from my bag. "Can you show me where I'm going on this map here?" I liked the easy way he leaned his forearms on the counter, rested the deck of cards on his palm, and pointed to various spots as he spoke. "The island's bigger than people think, 23 miles long. There's six towns. We're here in Vineyard Haven, one of the two main ports. You're going up what they call Up Island to Chilmark. Lots of farms up there. At the other end is Fancy Eggetown. It's like New England land at Disney World. You need big bucks to hang around there. The bar at Altria has amazing 2-for-1 gin gimlets on Tuesdays, though."
I think that's a good place to good place to stop.
Okay.
All right. And so that's the sort of the frame story.
Yes.
And then fairly soon you get into the World War II era story.
Yes. Well, Mrs. Devereaux eventually picks her up at the boat and brings her back to this beautiful farm.
Yeah. And I understand that farm is that copper, what's it called? Copper Pond Farm?
Copper Pond Farm.
Is based on a real place too.
It's based on where my mom grew up.
Ah. And the place where they swim that.
Oh, Copper Pond.
Yes. So tell me, is that a real thing?
No, that's part of my imagination. There was a place that we rented years and years ago, and they had a pond like that. And I kind of melded the two places.
Oh, cool. And so it had some minerals in it that make you, so it's kind of like Sulphur Springs or something, you know, where the minerals help are health giving and help you feel good.
And make your skin.
Yeah.
Make your skin really. It's a good skinny dipping.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Yes, yes. You know, it's interesting because we have this kind of this tendency to think that everybody was very prim, proper, and upright that long ago, mm-hmm. and yet it was really not the case, was it? There
not
was
not the case at all.
I wonder if there's ever been a time where there wasn't a lot of what'd you say, out of wedlock things happening.
No, even in the caves, back to Neanderthal times, it was always happening.
Yes.
You know, it's funny you mention that because my agent at one point was like, "Oh, I don't think that would have happened back then." I was like, "Are you kidding me? There were plenty of babies born out of wedlock."
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Or shotgun marriages, and
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yes. Maybe even more in those days.
Yeah.
You know, because it was, you know, a death knell in society if you had a baby like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, I think, a way the world has gotten a lot better, or our society has improved a lot in that you don't, it's not necessarily ruining somebody's life if they get pregnant in the wrong circumstances or have a baby in the wrong circumstances. And
Like it was then.
Not like it was then.
I mean, it really, really was a black mark against him.
Yeah. When you wrote your first book, Lilac Girls, Did you have any idea it would be as successful as it was? And how did that happen for you?
Oh my God. You know, I have to laugh. No. I thought, I'm just going to write this. You know, I became obsessed with the story when I went up to visit Caroline Faraday's house in, it's now a museum called the Bellamy Faraday House and Gardens in Bethlehem, Connecticut. And the lilacs, oh my God. This time of year there, the tour buses come in with book clubs because they all come to pay homage to Caroline Faraday. But when I first visited there, I was the only person on the tour that day. And I just fell in love with her story of how she brought, she championed this group of concentration camp survivors, Polish Catholic women that had been experimented on at Ravensbrück concentration camp in Germany. And I just wrote it for myself in a way. I thought, how do you even write a book? I had two journalism degrees, but I had never taken a creative writing class. And I just kind of taught myself how to do it. And I thought, you know, I'll write this for me and I'll send it to a couple of agents. And if they don't want it, then I'll just self-publish it. And I sent it out to five agents. It took me 10 years to write. So it wasn't an easy process, but I was determined to tell that story. I just felt like they needed to have their story told. And Caroline, too, we don't have that many women that we can really look up to in this country. And she like instantly became my hero. So,
and was she still alive when you first went?
No, she had died in the 90s. Yeah. And I discovered the story in 2000.
Okay.
She'd already been gone, but she left this incredible archive down in the root cellar of the old barn. Now, when you go to the house, you check in and downstairs, just so you know, you're walking on top of her archives, which she kept everything. So I used to go up there when I had little kids and my husband would take care of the kids, and I'd just go up there and go through her things and get to know her. I did that. It took me 10 years to write. And then I started writing down in Atlanta when I went through the Starbucks drive-through to get my usual decaf cappuccino grande. And by mistake, the barista gave me a caffeinated one. And I went home and it all started coming out. But by the time I sent queries out to agents, four agents got back to me and offered me representation out of the five that I sent out. And I just thought, well, how did that happen? Nobody knows who I am. But what I realized is if you write something that agents think that they can sell, it doesn't matter if you're James Patterson. It just matters that it's a good story that they think they can share with the world. So that's what happened. And it was an instant New York Times bestseller the week that it came out, which I'm still shocked about. I don't know how Random House did that because nobody knew who I was. And then the next year it was on the list for 54 weeks.
Well, the fact that you know, you were able to get an agent as a debut novelist and they were able to sell the book to Random House is pretty amazing. This is not what happens to everybody.
They were amazed too, frankly. I think they're still kind of like, whoa, how did that happen? Yale asked them to come and speak about how they did it. It was that amazing. Didn't ask me to come, but they asked the team. They asked the team. It was so happy for them. They were delighted. And I just thought, wow, when Yale asks you to come talk about your publishing experience, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now, you know, World War II stories do seem to have kind of an evergreen appeal. And yet there are still so many untold stories.
Oh my God. I discover them every day.
Yeah. And do you have any others in mind for books?
Not World War II. And you know, the difference in this book that I had so much fun with, and I love writing about European World War II, but this is my first stateside World War II book. And I think that's a little bit more of a rare creature. Because people usually write about, you know, everything's in Paris or Germany. So that is different. But no, my next book is another Martha's Vineyard book, and it's about The rise of folk music in the 1970s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's been
So,
really fun to do the research on it.
what role did Martha Vineyard play in that?
Well, I actually, this is the first book that I was alive and remember this time in the 70s. Well, James Taylor and Carly Simon were here.
Oh,
Yeah,
okay.
they both grew up here summers. And yeah, so I can't say too much more about that, but
No.
it's inspired by them. I wouldn't say it is. It's not like a biography by any means of them, but it is inspired by them. And it's been a lot of fun to go out to Laurel Canyon and Los Angeles to do the research on that.
Well, your timing is pretty good with that, because of the popularity of the Bob Dylan movie. I think it's gotten maybe people interested in that the folk route kind of thing.
Yes,
Yeah.
I think so too. I didn't even like Bob Dylan that much, and I love that movie.
I know. I grew up listening to Joan Baez and Peter, Paul and Mary.
Oh,
Because
yeah.
my mother was a folk guitarist and taught.
Oh my
She taught
God.
folk
I was going to
guitar.
say,
Yeah.
you were too young for that.
No.
That was before your time a little bit.
No. No, it was not. No, it was not. I am 66, so
No way.
yeah.
Oh my God. You're still younger than me. You know,
Okay.
I feel like I kind of missed that era.
Well, yeah, we were a cut. I was sort of the tail end of it, except that my
Yeah.
mother was, like I said, a folk guitarist and taught folk guitar. And so I was just telling, we were just actually the other day, and she's about to turn 90, but the other day on the phone,
Wow.
we were talking about some of the songs I remember her singing when she'd be downstairs practicing at night after we went to bed, and some of the folk songs. There was Barbara Allen was one that I
Okay,
really
let me
remember.
write these down. This is really good research.
So Barbara Allen is an old English folk song. I think Joan Baez might have done a version of that one. And then there was this one about that was a Civil War song. I don't know the title of it, but it's like
Ooh,
two
love
brothers,
of syphilis.
yeah, two brothers on their way. One wore blue and one wore gray. And as they
Awesome.
marched along the way, all on a beautiful
Ooh.
morning. And
Oh my God, you have that still, you still remember the
I
lyrics.
remember the lyrics, I remember the melodies, and what was the other one? I forget now what the other one was that we were that we and I had to kind of jog her memory. It had been a long time since she'd sung those, but she did remember them. So
Well, she's gonna like this book,
yeah,
the
for
new book.
sure. Absolutely.
Right now, I'm calling it More Than Famous. So,
Oh, okay.
yeah. So I think she'll like it. It's a whole different thing, as you can imagine, from writing about World War II. But
Definitely.
it's
Yeah.
fun.
Yeah. So Martha's Vineyard does really seem to have a hold on people that have been, people who live there. Like one of my business partners, her mother moved there, after she was grown and gone, but she would go every summer to visit her mother. And still, now that her mother passed away during COVID, and she still goes every summer to Martha's Vineyard.
Really? Oh, there's something really, really special about it. Yeah, I don't know what it is. John Belushi is buried here, and he used to come here, and he said that he never slept better in his life. It's actually on his gravestone that he said that. And my mom said the same thing. And last night I just arrived, and I had the best sleep of my life. I don't know what it is. It's the air, it's something. And you know what? It's just a really kind place. And I think it's a sanctuary in a way. People really love coming here and they can just be who they want to be. It's great.
Wow. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you today, Martha Hall Kelly, author of the Martha's Vineyard Beach and Book Club. We didn't talk too much about the book club aspect of it, so just give us a little hint of what did they do in their book club?
Oh, wow. It's inspired by my own mom's friends and their reading circle. They get into some trouble as a book club. I really feel like book clubs are more than just reading the book. It's women bonding. It's what they do while they're talking about the books. And in this book, they, as a group, it's a new book club that they, they talk about no Richie's allowed. They want like a book club that's just like their friends and normal people. But it turns into that little group of people while they're reading the books and doing things like getting the SAEs made, the Armed Services Editions. They, in my book, they make the first of those little books to give to the soldiers. So they do things like that, but they also, as a group, get caught up in this mystery of what is happening with this mysterious person that washed up on shore. So a lot of their time is taken up with that, but they also bond together through this group of women, and that's what sees them through. Because I think that's books really saw people through in the war. And my mom used to talk about it all the time. I mean, she was very young. They were reading like Black Beauty and the Little House on the Prairie books back then, but it still was a way to be together and talk about something other than the fact that her father had just passed away and her uncle Sonny, I mean, her brother, my uncle Sonny, was shot down in the war over Italy, and he was he was missing in action.
Wow.
So it was a way for them to take their minds off of it and be together and have a positive thing to talk about.
Well, thank you, Martha. We're out of time for today, and I'm going to close with a quote about books from Groucho Marx. It says, "Outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read."
Oh my God. That is the perfect wrap up. I'll tell you. Oh, love him.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.